Hello and welcome to the Acromegaly Update. It's Monday, May 25th, 2026. I'm your host, and today's episode has two segments. First, we dig into this week's peer-reviewed acromegaly research, and there's a genuinely useful pharmacology paper that landed in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Then in our second segment, we step back to look at the wider rare disease industry. And the story dominating that space right now is FDA leadership instability, and what it's doing to investor confidence in companies targeting small patient populations. Let's get into it. Segment 1, Acromegaly Research. This week's standout paper is a network meta-analysis published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. The lead author is Roberto Salvatori, and the team pulled together 22 records from 18 randomized controlled trials to do something acromegaly clinicians have wanted for a long time: compare pharmacological treatments head-to-head, even when direct trials don't exist. Because in acromegaly, we don't have many trials that actually pit drug against drug, so this kind of indirect comparison is genuinely valuable. The headline finding is reassuring in a certain way. Biochemical control rates were roughly comparable among the long-acting injectable somatostatin receptor ligands, lanreotide, octreotide, and pasireotide. The analysis uses Bayesian statistics to rank probabilities, and the bottom line is that you're unlikely to see one SRL decisively outperforming another in terms of biochemical control. What this means practically is that the initial choice among injectable SRLs can reasonably be driven by patient tolerability, dosing convenience, and insurance coverage, not by an expectation that one is meaningfully more effective than another. This is the kind of evidence that feeds into guidelines, and it puts comparative effectiveness for injectable SRLs largely to rest. The second paper this week comes from Sahlgrenska University Hospital in Sweden, a retrospective study of 82 patients who were surgically treated for acromegaly between 1994 and 2019. The question is one that comes up regularly in clinic. What do you do when GH and IGF-1 don't agree after surgery? One's normal, the other isn't. That's called biochemical discordance, and the researchers found it in nearly 1 in 5 of their patients, 19.5% of the cohort. The dominant pattern, seen in 14 of the 16 discordant cases, was elevated IGF-1 alongside a normalized nadir GH on oral glucose tolerance testing. The key risk factor they identified: higher IGF-1 at diagnosis. So patients who came in with more active disease at baseline were more likely to end up in this ambiguous postoperative zone. The practical implication is clear. If someone walks in with a very elevated IGF-1 before surgery, plan for the possibility that postoperative monitoring may be complicated and stay attentive to IGF-1 even if GH looks fine. Third paper of the week, also from the journal Pituitary, looks at a question in surgical pathology that remains genuinely unsettled. Does it matter clinically whether a somatotroph adenoma also stains positive for prolactin? A lot of acromegaly tumors co-express prolactin on immunohistochemistry, but what that means for prognosis and treatment response isn't agreed upon. This Turkish retrospective study followed 90 patients over 15 years and compared outcomes between GH-only adenomas and those that co-expressed prolactin. Their finding adds nuance. Prolactin co-expression doesn't appear to straightforwardly translate into worse outcomes. That's useful information for clinicians who might be worried when the pathology report comes back with PRL positivity. The data here suggest it doesn't automatically mean a harder road ahead. The fourth paper addresses a practical monitoring question. How do we track bone health in acromegaly patients? The disease increases skeletal fragility, but DXA has recognized limitations in this population. The Italian team recruited 56 patients with acromegaly and 59 matched healthy controls and compared calcaneal quantitative ultrasound, a less expensive radiation-free method, against DXA. The good news, QS parameters correlated strongly with DXA measurements. This doesn't replace DXA overnight, but it suggests QS could be a useful tool for serial bone monitoring, particularly in settings where DXA is expensive or less accessible. A practical addition to the acromegaly comorbidity toolkit. That's the acromegaly research picture for this week. 4 solid papers, with the NMA and JCM as the clear lead item. Now, zooming out from acromegaly to the wider rare disease industry. this week's news is dominated by a single uncomfortable theme: what FDA leadership instability is doing to the companies trying to get drugs approved for small patient populations. The setting was the STAT Breakthrough Summit West in San Francisco, which took place on May 20th. Rare disease biotech CEOs gathered for a panel discussion, and the mood was frank. Mazi Therapeutics CEO Yael Weiss described it vividly. She said she has not had a day without an investor email asking how the personnel chaos at the FDA will affect her company's future. Her word for it was a roller coaster. Former Bio chairman Ted Love was also on the panel, and together they dug into not just the leadership vacuum, which has followed several high-profile departures from the agency, but also what it means for how the FDA is approaching clinical trial design flexibility for rare disease programs. One of the core tensions in rare disease drug development is that you often can't run a large randomized trial because the patient population simply doesn't exist at that scale. The FDA has historically been willing to be flexible, but that flexibility depends on institutional knowledge and consistent relationships between companies and reviewers. When those reviewers leave and when leadership is in flux, that continuity breaks down. And that's what's making investors nervous. The second story worth your attention comes from the same STAT summit, the day before, on May 19th. A family from the rare disease community shared the story of their daughter, Jory, who was born with an ultra-rare genetic disorder caused by a deletion affecting chromosome 10. The constellation of symptoms was severe. Problems with her heart, her legs, her larynx, her ability to breathe. Doctors at Mayo Clinic rapidly sequenced her genome and then used an artificial intelligence tool called the Biomedical Data Translator, built by a consortium with funding from the National Institutes of Health, to search biomedical databases for existing compounds that could counteract her specific condition. The tool identified clonopin, which is clonazepam, a widely available drug typically used for seizure disorders and panic attacks. The response was described as being almost instantaneous. A child who had spent months in the NICU and years hitting developmental plateaus suddenly gained motor function. The story doesn't end with just Jory. A second patient with a similar mutation received the same treatment and reportedly went from not-noting to speaking in sentences. The lead physician said flatly that they would not have reached this answer without the AI tool. It was able to make connections across the biomedical literature that humans couldn't make on their own. Why does this matter for rare disease drug development? Because it illustrates both the enormous promise and the infrastructure gap in rare and undiagnosed disease. The AI can find candidates, the genome can be sequenced, but scaling that process across different health systems, different geographies, diverse patient populations remains a major challenge, and it represents a gap that rare disease therapeutics companies and diagnostics developers are actively trying to address. As a brief note, just outside our 7-day window, Astellas announced the resumption of clinical trials for a gene therapy in X-linked myotubular myopathy, a fatal muscle-wasting disease that had earlier derailed a prior program following patient deaths. The new candidate uses a dramatically lower dose and more liver-sparing approach. That trial is now enrolling in phase half. Worth keeping on your radar. Bringing both segments together to close out, this week illustrates the two speeds at which the acromegaly field moves. The research is grinding forward methodically. We now have the strongest comparative pharmacology evidence yet that injectable SRLs are largely interchangeable on efficacy, and we have clearer data on who's at risk for post-surgical monitoring challenges. But the industry environment around rare disease drug development, which is where acromegaly's pipeline lives, is being buffeted by regulatory turbulence that has nothing to do with the science. The FDA story is one to follow closely. If the agency stabilizes its leadership and restores institutional continuity, rare disease developers will exhale. If the uncertainty persists, financing for programs in small patient populations, including acromegaly, will remain harder than it should be. That's the Acromegaly Update for Monday, May 25th. We'll be back next week.